Good morning and welcome. I'd like to thank everyone for joining today's episode of Broadcast to Post. I'm your host, Jeff Sengpiel, Chief Technologist here at Keycode Media. When we all think of the state of post-production in 2021, the words, it's complicated, come to mind. Maybe even a little awkward. No two companies or production are doing workflow exactly the same way. Some have their editors and producers working completely remote. Others have everyone in the office quarantined to individual edit bays. Some have clients visiting in person, while others won't let anyone enter the building until 2022, whether client or creative staff. Yep, it's complicated. I'll be joined shortly by some of the top post-production engineers today to address this complicated state that we're in and share real stories, real examples of how post-production operations are addressing the challenges faced by staff, management, and most importantly, the end customer. Our panel spends every day solving these business and workflow challenges for companies just like yours. Today, we're going to focus on the essential parts of the post-production process: ingest and distribution, creative edit, finishing, management, review and approval throughout, and delivery and archive from a 2021 perspective. Now, let's introduce the panel for our exciting topic, post-production workflow in 2021, hybrid teams and management. In alphabetical order, Ed Locke. Ed's got over 20 years of experience in IT and entertainment technology, working for companies like Prudential, the Walt Disney Company, and Avid Technology. Ed participated in the migration of TV stations from linear to digital operations, traveling to dozens of stations throughout the country, deploying, training, and providing on-air support for new digital infrastructures. Recently, he's designed and continues to manage multi-million dollar solutions for companies such as Trinity Broadcasting Network, Fuse TV, and KCRW. Dan Wagner, he's our senior solutions architect. He brings 30 years of experience working in all aspects of video production. He's been specific to post-production. Dan is an avid ACSR and ACI. He's considered to be one of the most knowledgeable solution providers in post-production system design. Dan also leads all aspects of training for Keycode Media's post-production clients, providing customers tips and tricks and accelerating staff technology adoption. Tom Faber, he's also a solutions architect for Keycode Media, located out of Chicago. He specializes in storage, asset management, and archive. Armed with a screwdriver, a spool of cable, and his laptop, Tom travels nationwide installing and training on many of the solutions that Keycode Media specializes in. And myself, I come to Keycode with extensive knowledge in the world of episodic television and feature film post-production and finishing. My credits include engineering oversight on shows like Madam Secretary, Star Trek, GLOW, Game of Thrones, and features like Christmas Chronicles, I Feel Pretty, and Hotel Artemis, plus all the fun work in reality and post-for-live workflows like American Idol and the Oscars. All right, so let's start off with some more general questions before we get into the nitty-gritty. Some post-production managers are looking for affordable and secure ways of having teams operate seamlessly in the office and at home. Hybrid workflow or work from anywhere. Others are trying to figure out the safest way to get people back to editing in the office. While a few are all in, closing the office off and trying to have the entire team work remote. So what types of conversations are you having with customers, and ultimately, what are the final solutions you're seeing getting deployed? Dan, let's start with you on that.
Okay. Well, the conversations we're having with folks really centers around the HP RGS or Z-Central application, because many of our sites are interplay based and things like that. So they're production management based. And so therefore they already have HP computer workstations as their editing workstations. So couple that whole system, just make sure you have a good VPN. And it's pretty affordable for businesses or companies to have their editorial staff remote in and start doing their job, start cutting. And that's the biggest conversation we're having. I will say that we also are dependent on that connection, that internet connection from the editor's home to the office, up to that VPN there. If that connection, that's a connection that we need to make sure is solid in order to have the best experience for them.
That's one of the things I've been running into as well. I'll be talking to clients, you know, in an area. One of the things that in the LA area, when I mentioned certain internet service providers and how I've had difficulty with my own, they're like, oh yeah, I've got problems with them too. So that's one of the things, you know, we're not the only ones who went remote and are trying to control things. Ed, Tom, what conversations are you seeing out there?
I'm kind of seeing along the same idea where we're more of a hybrid solution here in the Midwest area. A couple days from the office, a couple days from home. So usually someone's always kind of at the office doing that media management no matter what. So with social distancing and all that sort of stuff, someone's there to manage that. But most of the time it is using, like Dan alluded to, HPRGS, being able to be in front of the machine physically or remotely definitely helps in that case there.
Yeah, and I would say what I've run into pretty commonly lately is using some sort of asset management system to actually produce a streaming editable proxy and actually just editing using regular editing systems at home. And then just leveraging that proxy to get access to the media that they need.
Well, and one of the conversations that actually is coming back to the table these days is Mac remote. You know, a year and a half ago, we were having conversations with people where it would begin with, well, we've got to convert you to PC to make this work right. And, you know, the answer was no, we're not, we would rather fight than switch. And 3 weeks later, they're calling saying, yeah, let's do this. We kind of need to continue to produce content. But Mac solutions have come a long way. Jump desktops out there, and there's some other things that have come to the party. So one thing to point out about hybrid. So we've talked about hybrid in terms of some people in the office, some people out of the office. The other hybrid piece that's out there is some people on-prem and some people editing in the cloud. So there's two different hybrid things going on there. So just to be clear on that. So let's get through the process. The beginning of the post-production process is ingest. So getting data in and then getting it distributed to folks who may be at home or may be on-prem. A lot of times there's TV shows with fast turnarounds, marketing departments that need to start editing promo. As the shoot's going on, ingest workflows have evolved over the years. What do you see they're going to end up as new camera to cloud and proxy now, full res later workflows have developed? Ed, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, and there's no like one answer that applies to everyone. These really are very detailed conversations with each individual client. A few examples come to mind. We were working with a large Christian broadcaster. And they're out recording remotely in the field, you know, high resolution, sometimes multi-camera shoots. And, you know, they don't have the infrastructure in place, and it would be very costly to build all of the file acceleration and all of that to actually try and get these files from a remote location. So they are still, you know, finding a way to get that media to one of their offices around the country, get that ingested, and then have proxies created that allow pretty quick access to it for, you know, things like, you know, review and approval, and just producers to be able to go in and see what was shot and things like that. And similarly, we've got a corporate client out on the East Coast that they have three primary locations, and it did make sense for them to leave a certain storage footprint on premises and do their high resolution recording and, you know, get that basically there. And on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, we've got an ed tech company that we've been working with that, you know, we look for silver linings when all of the chaos of something like COVID happens. And, you know, what worked out for them is they got out of shooting these videos in studios and started to just do them over Zoom and webcams. And that created a much, lighter footprint as far as the media files were concerned. And they're a global company that were previously isolated to editing on the East Coast in the United States, and they really wanted to distribute that. So we were able to take that entire workflow and spin that up in the cloud to where they're actually going into AWS tools to see the content that they've got, download that directly to S3 storage that's abstracted through File and Storage Gateway, and streaming proxies created from there. Anyone, anywhere in the world can edit you with the same exact experience from anyone else. So we are seeing a variety of workflows, and it really depends on the, you know, the intricacies of the exact workflow to determine, you know, which variant of that is going to work best.
I always love it when production comes along and says, we're going to fix it in production. We won't fix it in post anymore. It's just the best thing ever. Tom, any experiences you've had with the ingest workflow?
Yeah, definitely kind of what Ed alluded to is sometimes, you know, depending on how much footage you have to bring up, is it a full-on production shoot where you're going to have terabytes of data, or is it just a little, you know, talking head interview or a little quick shoot? Big thing is we're seeing VPNs, you know, get a lot better. So you can VPN to your storage, upload a proxy, upload a high res. We are seeing a lot more third-party transcoding softwares in the mix. So files will automatically hit an ingest. The workflow is designed to archive that camera raw media as well as create a proxy right off the bat. Or, you know, like Ed said as well, the having someone physically in the office. So a media manager that's always there, managing the hard drives that are coming in, coming out, creating those proxies, letting editors know, hey, these are good to use. So whether you're going to use something like Avid Editorial that's going to be using cloud-based, or you're going to go through like SNS and using Nomad and those proxies, whether those are the low-res view proxies or there are new edit proxies, which are ProRes now, you can have those options. So we're definitely seeing that hybrid option. It really depends on how much footage is coming in. And that's why you leverage a system integrator like Keycode Media, so we can sit down, look at your workflow, and give you the best options that are out there.
And folks keep coming up with new options. I mean, our friends at Adobe just acquired Frame.io, and they had just come out with their camera to cloud workflow, getting low-res proxies there quickly. And then later, as you've been able to get the high-res media in place, replace them in the background, and then create viewing proxies. So that quick turnaround stuff. Dan, any thoughts on this one?
What I have actually seen that we've been using with one of our clients for quite a while now with Frame.io is they have an organization or a production company out on the East Coast that is conducting the Zoom type meeting and recording all of the ISO feeds and things like that. They are uploading the original footage to Frame.io, and then there's a media manager back in California that would grab that content and drop it on local storage, and then it goes through Content Agent and gets checked into the asset management we've got there, and should be archived right up there at the front in case of disaster recovery or somebody doesn't have access to the Frame.io, whatever connectivity issues and things like that might arise, you at least have a separate repository of that information or of that footage there on premises at a facility that is operated by the client.
Very cool. So getting on to the next part, shared storage and management. First of all, where is this today? There are options that didn't exist before, like all the data, you put it up in the cloud and then you deliver it via Lucidlink to Adobe or Avid editors, wherever they are, streaming from the cloud to old school Sneakernet. There's the daunting task of making sense of all of these assets and organizing it for edit teams, and then making the media and files easy to use. How has hybrid or cloud impacted storage and managing of files? And as organizations grow, is the media storage and management an evolution or a revolution? I'll take point on this one. We've got a client here in LA. They have an on-prem storage system. It is actually an Avid Nexus. And then they're pushing to, they started by pushing to cloud and then distributing media out to editorial, and then keeping the on-prem Nexus and then the cloud as the source of truth. Now, that was a storage DNA, shared workspaces, fabric shared workspaces in storage DNA workflow. The other thing that has come online lately is Lucidlink and being able to put your data into the cloud bucket and being able to stream it with, you know, some caching locally, and you know, having the edit system realize, you know, or think that everything is local, and that's been that's kind of a game changer there, because the a lot of folks have also come out with you know, shared storage in the cloud. So they're taking a file system, whether it's, you know, say our friends from EditShare or from Avid, and they're putting that file system on top of a high performance cloud instance of storage, and then presenting it, you know, with the same interface that everybody's come to know and understand, and then letting folks work, you know, attached to that. Usually those are closed ecosystems, and, you know, there's been some angst over how quickly we can get things in and out of those, or mainly into those cloud buckets. And folks have been working on trying to improve that around. So the management of all that, figuring out where everything is, that's been one of the you know, the core challenges, I think. Some of the, you know, storage folks like StorageDNA will definitely do that with Fabric. SNS can do it with being exposed to buckets and knowing where everything is. That's one of the keys of knowing where everything is, what the cost of that storage is for you, whether it's, you know, what's the cost of your spinning disks that are in the room over there, or what's the cost of it sitting in the cloud, and the cost to pull that out. That's one of the key things, basically identifying it. And that also speaks to archive, because we'll get to that later at the end, where some people think it belongs. But it's one of those pieces where knowing that what you've got at archive, and, you know, your security of your media in terms of redundant copies, and following that, as the archive produced archive companies say, the 3-2-1 setup. Ed, any thoughts on shared storage and management of it?
Yeah, well, I mean, at least in the world where I live, I view this much more as an evolution rather than a revolution. I mean, for decades now, I've been a big proponent of using some kind of automation systems to help, you know, optimize your workflow and really allow you to embrace a lot of the newer technologies. And I think the cloud platforms that are available today, and we're seeing more and more prevalent, integrate very nicely into that. I mean, it used to be a simple world. You had a SAN, you sized the SAN for how much media it needed. Maybe you put an LTO on the back end. And that even got complicated even before we had the big push to go to the cloud. And you've got, you know, just speaking on AWS, you've got S3, you've got Glacier, you've got, you know, the block storage that's there. And oftentimes there still is an on-prem LTO, because that can be and often is the least expensive way to keep that ever-growing repository of media. And in addition to that, you know, when you're in the cloud, you want to integrate oftentimes with transcoding solutions, artificial intelligence services, and things like that. So in my mind, you know, it is really just expanding that world of, you know, building some intelligence into your workflow, adding these asset management and automation tools, and really allows you to more effectively leverage some of these tools. You know, Jeff, you mentioned, you know, ingress and egress charges and how to manage that by being able to build rules so that you are in complete control of what media exists on what tier of storage for how long and when. You can start to kind of take control of that, as opposed to getting a surprise at the end of the month when you realize that you far exceeded what you had originally planned for your cloud costs. So definitely an evolution. I think it's a natural progression. You know, the services that are up there in the cloud from a storage standpoint, they're very robust and you know, integrate really well into that methodology.
And the other interesting thing about cloud services, that you've got the storage there, you're paying for it. There's supplemental services that can be around that. If you're in one of the, you know, commercial cloud providers, facial recognition, translation, transcription, all those pieces are available. But then, you know, people also swing both ways. Some folks are concerned about the sovereignty of their data and the security of their data, versus having it on-prem, where they feel they've got a better grasp on it, and those are all conversations that we're having with clients, you know, today. Dan, Tom, any thoughts on this one?
I just think, you know, being able to track where this data is extremely important. You know, back in the day, everything would typically be on premises, but now you're having to manage it on premises, on, you know, in a cloud storage somewhere, maybe on a half a dozen editors' workstations at home, and a hard drive that's probably in shipment between point A and point B. So having the right tools to be able to track and manage that are essential, as well as having a person to deal with that. A lot of times we're so focused on the hardware, the technology, but you still really need to have a person that's shepherding all of this information. And therefore, I think the role of the media manager is constantly evolving and expanding in its scope and, frankly, its importance.
Which makes sense, you know, having a person in the organization who knows, or persons, because the thing I always say when I'm talking with clients is, if you've got one person who knows where everything is, if they get hit by a winning lotto ticket, all bets are off. And so you want to make sure that you've got at least, you know, an institutional knowledge behind that as well. So getting into editing and finishing suites, getting to the creative side. So Mac versus PC, that's been an interesting change of late. There's been new things that have come to the table with remote access and chipsets. Getting into reference monitors versus a remote control environment where you don't necessarily have that. Setting up your edit and finish desk, maybe even in the back bedroom. Not to mention, you know, the network that was alluded to before. You know, giving people that smooth editorial experience and low latency. What advice are we giving to people trying to design, edit, and color suites, and the facility behind it in today's day and age? Not to mention the other fact that sometimes the facility is a data colo. Tom, what are you seeing out there?
Like we've mentioned before, you know, the HP RGS is a great solution. It's out there. Lucid Link is also, you know, really great for getting video footage to remote editors, Mac or PC. But yeah, it's definitely, you know, becoming an ever-changing solution, more or less. So, you know, we're seeing, you know, mostly Mac is still going to be Lucid Link, some VPN connections, cloud editing, stuff like that, and that are there. But when you get down to the real nitty-gritty of the finish suite, you know, it's, do you want to have an editor or a finish artist, a color artist, taking home, you know, a $10, $15, $20,000 monitor for to do HDR color correction? Or is that going to be, hey, guess what? You know, that finishing is going to be on site just because of insurance reasons. You know, putting that in the back of a car, a lot of insurance companies are going to say no to ship that out and stuff like that. So we're definitely seeing that. Otherwise, you know, we're seeing solutions like Streambox to do, you know, HDR 4K video, you know, over the internet that way. Is definitely helping. Going data colo, you know, it's mostly going to be that remote editorial, VPN connections, you know, making sure you have the correct networking. You know, your days of going just 10 gig out of your SAN solution up to your switch, when you're doing data colo with multiple editors, you're now talking to the point of 20, 50, 100 gig up out of the back of SANs to switches like that. So we're definitely seeing that sort of setup. We've obviously talked about a lot, the whole high res, low res proxy. So you can do a lot of remote editorial using proxies, using asset management solutions like that. So it's definitely out there. It's ever growing, but you know, we can make almost any solution work that may need to be done.
Exactly. And the one thing that's interesting about the Lucid Link solution is the edit bay you had in the facility can be the edit bay you have at your home. You know, you can set it up with, you know, 5171 HDR monitoring, all that stuff. And then the media is just streamed down, which is a little different than having your edit system live in the cloud. Yeah. Or live on-prem in your remote controlling it. So it's interesting to see where specific types of productions have wanted to go with that. A lot of the high-end, very high-end finishing things for theatrical, they set up locations on-prem, you know, in people's houses where they've got the entire, you know, scenario set up. And then they're shipping around iPad Pros, which have the ability to do like P3 color or HDR color and streaming out via Streambox. Ed, Dan, any other thoughts on the finish side of it?
Just that it's, you know, it's all fun and games until you get to that color critical phase of editorial. And it's, you know, it's either a fair amount of expense and logistics coordination in order to get that to still be done remotely, or it's, you know, finding some strategically located, brick and mortar buildings where you can have, you know, people come in and do that work.
That's a discussion I've had with people too. You know, they get to the, everyone went home and there's no one in the office. And the finisher said, well, how am I going to see my scopes? How am I going to go into the office? There's nobody there. You're the only one. So as long as janitorial empties the garbage cans, you're going to be pretty good.
Back in the day though, that experience when you had a row of edit bays and one editor might pop into the edit bay to ask the other editor a question. You know, it's a very collaborative environment. Or a producer will stop in because they needed to quickly review a cut or something like that. But there was this communication component between everybody. And when you're not in the same physical space to communicate with each other, what do you use? And a lot of folks have adapted Teams and Zoom webinars, usually running on another computer off to the side. You don't want to have that type of system connectivity bogging down your editing machine. So that was a laptop or an old iMac or something sitting on that. They dusted off and brought into the environment there. But it's important to have the team still be able to communicate. So yes, this is where all the Zooms and Teams and WebExes and all of those, all that technology comes together, and it's still used as a separate component, but it is a new component in edit bays I've seen pop up since the COVID hit.
And the other piece that's being used there is Slack. I've seen a lot of folks using Slack, or I hear a lot of folks using Slack, because you can hear the Slack chime go off when you're talking to people like, oh, you're a Slack organization, I know. So talking about the fun and games that Ed was alluding to before, that get to happen before finishing, creative editorial, we've got our friends from Avid and Adobe as sponsors of our event, and thanks to both of them. So let's start with the Avid workflows, and then we'll get to the Adobe workflows. What are the cool ways people are leveraging new Avid workflows? What are those moments in the customer discussion where Avid's going to be the best fit and there's an aha moment? Dan, let's start with you on that one.
I think a lot of it is that ability to really work well in a team environment still, and that where everybody went home, but we still need to all access the common media. We still need to share projects and things like that. And so the aha moment that I've been seeing is folks realizing that the workflow we're doing remotely is different, but it's not that different if we're able to harness the power of RGS, Lucid Link, et cetera, the VPN access to literally driving the computer that, you know, 18 months ago, the editor was physically sitting in front of. So that's kind of an aha moment. It's like, oh, we can do this. Okay, this is a good thing. We can get our show are out the door and delivered. So, and also when it comes to the media management and review and approval process, I'm seeing folks start to take, at least in the Avid environment, they're taking, they're harnessing cloud UX and using that for some review and approval processes. Cloud UX is a browser-based look into your production management system. You can do some basic editing with it, string out, collecting clips, project organization, all without having to tie up a physical or virtual editing bay per se. So your loggers, your producers, even your camera department might throw a bunch of clips together and say, hey, check these out. This is what I'm thinking you might want to access or something like that. There's all sorts of, it's another tool that is allowing everybody to communicate and collaborate together. And it's based on a web browser. It's pretty, you know, lightweight.
One of the other things also I've seen on some of the Avid workflows is talking to people about edit on demand. Now, we don't show people edit on demand. We tell them, okay, get your hands on it, play with it. And they come back to us and say, yeah, it's Media Composer. It's got shared storage. And that works out interestingly for folks that never owned the gear to begin with. They were, you know, living in the rental world, and now they're in a world where they don't want a facility. And there's some interesting pieces there. So getting into the Adobe side, then we'll open this up. Adobe has their full Creative Cloud suite. And you've got Adobe Productions for Premiere Pro, which lets you have that collaboration and the file locking. How's the family of products that are coming from Adobe changing the way teams edit? Are we seeing customers diving deep into maybe the new Sensei engine or Sensei engine, the AI piece for speech to text? Lots to go over. Tom, what do you think of where Adobe's at the moment?
Where they're at now is great. It's definitely been increasing. Doing that collaboration tools is huge. You know, letting these editors work, you know, in cohesion with everybody else, kind of alleviates the ability to have to use, you know, rely on VPN connections back to the home office. But again, you're really still limited to the internet connection from your house because you're going to be uploading and downloading that data. So it is obviously some newer technology out there with newer hardware out there, whether it's the, you know, the HP systems that work out there, the M1 Max, or, you know, the new Mac Pros that are out there. It's definitely something to keep in mind that, you know, you might run into some hiccups every so often. So, you know, it still works great. We love it. But it's still, you know, this technology is changing so quickly that it's tough to keep everything in line. So we're seeing those. We're seeing products like SNS Share Browser has file locking, so you can VPN back in and grab projects, you know, use that sort of thing with the Nomad workflow, using proxies remotely, and then save it back, and it automatically links to high-res on site. So it's definitely there. Adding to what Dan was saying, you know, with the cloud UX, we're seeing asset management, whether it's IPV or CatDV, same idea. Just, you know, quickly drop a video in. You can build some rough and tumble videos, whether it's the producer or the camera department saying, hey, this is what I was thinking of shooting. Here's a marker. You can export that, bring that right into Adobe as an XML. The edit's closely done for you. Then your editor's just doing the final touches, you know, getting the dissolves and transitions correctly, dropping the video in or dropping audio in, matching cuts to audio. So it's definitely been growing as we see.
Cool. Any other thoughts on creative editorial before we move into review and approval?
No, I'll just say that as much of a proponent as I am of automation and asset management, I've been really impressed to see companies like Avid and Adobe really get, you know, some core collaboration capabilities integrated without having to deploy a large comprehensive infrastructure around it. So it's nice to see that these, you know, big companies that, you know, take care of a lot of the editing in the industry really see that collaboration need in editorial and are making it simpler and simpler every day.
And, you know, we've heard some things in the grapevine that there's going to be some very interesting developments over the next couple months for everybody. The fun thing is that statement always applies. There's always going to be interesting things just over the horizon. But in terms of the infrastructure being extruded, that's going to be some interesting stuff. All right, let's get into review and approval. One of the biggest changes we've seen is process of having clients and other stakeholders involved with the approval process and reviews. Used to be you'd sit around and, you know, watch the color graded version or be in the session. Or, you know, sometimes it was just simply a hyperlink and you got your private YouTube video and you watch that. So we're seeing all sorts of things from, you know, cheap and dirty to larger productions creating color accurate virtual meetings. And the whole over-the-shoulder concept, like some of the cloud providers like Bebop have out there. What are you folks seeing in terms of review and approval? There's a ton of tools out there, including the one we're on to have our chat here, Zoom and Vimeo. Tom, what are you seeing out there?
It's definitely been that review and approval hasn't really much changed in that, you know, remote review and approval tools have gotten better. Zoom, Vimeo, you know, private YouTube links are still kind of there, but, you know, people want to have that live interaction of let's do it this way, let's do it that way. So we're seeing a lot of screen sharing using, you know, Zoom tool, Teams, stuff like that. We're getting down to asset management uploads. So you export a quick and dirty, send it up to asset management. You can throw markers, you can throw notes, all the way up to high end, you know, Streambox. So one to many. So the editor's sitting there live. You could be in a Teams meeting, you know, so you have three or four producers watching that Streambox on an iPad, on a computer, from the editor that's feeding the Streambox sender. So there's all the options for it.
Ed, thoughts on this part of the process?
Yeah, I mean, I think to Tom's point, you know, remote review and approval has been going on for a long time, right? So it's still a lot of the same tools that are out there being used. Still have a lot of people using tools like Vimeo, private YouTube channels. You know, I won't belabor the MAM point, but integrating logging in, you know, inside of a MAM tool, we've seen that more tightly integrated communication is becoming more important, but a lot of the tools are the same as they've been for quite some time now.
Right, we've got a client that I'm working with that uses Frame.io quite a bit, have been for years, and you know, it's still the same process. You're exporting out of your NLE, you're uploading the video for some, and then sending links out to the stakeholders in the and at that for that particular stage of the production or post-production process and getting the feedback or getting that approval and then able to move on to the next step.
Yes, and what we were talking about with Zoom, the integration gets a little more interesting. Both Avid and Adobe have the ability to output and as an NDI feed, which can then go into a Zoom window. So while I'm seeing the four of us, there could be a fifth, which is the output of a nonlinear editor, and it's playing and we're all going back and forth in real time. And me as the editor, you know, muting people so they can't get their opinions out, that sort of thing. So there's lots of interesting integrations that we're seeing out there. So let's get into Archive. I want to talk a little bit about media management and Archive. We can't ignore the glacier in the room. Where's the media going after the production's wrapped out? I mean, it used to be a long time ago. We put a bunch of LTOs in the box, and the box would go to the back of the vault, and sooner or later, it would either, someone would come get it, or it would ship somewhere, and we didn't pay attention to it. What are we seeing in terms of Archive, gentlemen? And let's just toss it open.
I'm always been a big proponent of not waiting to the end of a project to start the, quote, Archive. I see that really as if you just move those exact same steps to the ingest stage, so it comes in, gets checked into your system, and gets sent to LTO at that same time. That usually is a process that can be automated. That not only speeds up your archive at the end of the process, where all you have to do is whatever that delta, whatever the changed media, whatever that finished pieces, it's ready. There's a lot less that needs to be archived at the end. But it also gives you some disaster recovery. The credit card got turned off on the web services that are the website provider that you were sending all your media up to or something like that. Or you're temporarily disconnected and you still need to get something out. At least you have, especially if you've got automation built into this, at least you have the ability to reach in and grab the assets that are needed in a what could be something less than ideal little time frame there when you have an emergency.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of clients that, you know, have had a long-term investment in on-premises LTO tapes, and still being the lowest cost way to archive that content, I don't see a mad rush to decommission those and put everything in what can be relatively expensive cloud. I mean, I've always said it comes down to this conversation and making sure we really understand active archive versus disaster recovery. So we are seeing more of a migration to say, hey, we're not going to put a redundant LTO system somewhere else in the country or the world. We're actually going to use something like Glacier as our long-term disaster recovery, where that can be put on a really inexpensive tier. But if you've got an active archive, if you've got large files, you're dealing with 4K, 8K media, and you need to, you know, recover that media in any type of regular basis, you know, having a on-premises solution to do that, you know, and unless you're just all in on the cloud, which, you know, we have some clients that are doing that as well, but certainly not seeing the mad rush of people that have that investment in LTO to migrate that all to cloud.
Yeah. Go ahead, Tom.
What we're kind of usually seeing, like Ed said, we're not seeing that secondary LTO somewhere else in the country. It's more of, we're going to push it to cloud, we're going to push it to LTO. And the only reason you're going to go to a cloud is when you have that insurance check, because it's going to cost a good ton of money to get that down. So the cloud is your DR for a big data set where they can ship you, you know, the drive set, and you can copy it off, and you're not going to be taking, you know, 2 to 3 weeks to restore that data off of LTO. Say you have to pull back hundreds of terabytes, you know, that's going to obviously take a while with some of these one or two drive systems. So we're definitely seeing that side of things. You know, we're still seeing on-prem LTO as one of the things. Archive on the beginning, you know, it hits an ingest, we have automation that moves it to a working volume, metadata is filled out, it gets sent to archive, it gets sent to cloud, and gets moved to the edit prem, or the edit storage at that point.
And just so all three of us say this, archive at the beginning, we all agree, archive early.
Archive early, archive often, because the other thing we've had discussions with clients about is they call saying, oh my God, I'm getting hit with ransomware right now, everything's locked up, or I had a disk fail, I've lost metadata. And we ask them, okay, you've got your backups, right? And their answer is, oh, we stopped doing that on X date. You can't shoot yourself in the foot. Archive, you can't ignore it, because it will all, that iceberg will always come back and sink your ship. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today and sharing some insight and dropping some knowledge. You know, if you've got further questions, please, you know, get a hold of us here at Keycode Media. We've got answers. And as you can tell, the answers are going to depend upon a bit of a discussion. There is no real stock way to do this. If there was, then everybody would be doing post-production. But you folks who are watching are special, and let's have a chat about what you need to do and what you need to do to go forward. And remember what we said, the end of the year is coming up, and prices are going up and availability is becoming more and more difficult. So if you've got a project you want to start looking at for post-production, please reach out. Sooner is better than later, as you know, if you discover you've got a kickoff date, say in April, that could be tough on certain pieces of gear. So jump in early, jump in often, and thanks everybody for joining us today.
Bye guys.